Hello and welcome to Comic Talk Today for Thursday, May 24th, 2018. And because it's Thursday, it is time for me to receive some therapy. And there's one person that I know that could provide me with some therapy, and that is the great Con, Ben Con.
What up?
Have you ever been called the great Con? Was that your nickname in high school?
God, I wish it was that nice. Actually, you know what? You want to know what my honest-to-God nickname in high school was? Iceman.
Iceman? Why? Because he was so cool?
Yeah, right. No. So I used to run on the track team, and you write your name down on the card. They write the name down on the cards for the race, and someone botched my name so bad, like the K, like the line and like the things going out of the line for the K looked like two separate letters. So it looked like an IC, an A looked like an E, the H looked like an M. So like everyone's going around being like, hey, who the fuck is Ben Iceman? You got a Ben Iceman? I'm like, that's not any of the letters in my name. That can't be me. And then like, yeah, it's you. I'm like, okay then. And then honestly, it ended up being the kind of thing where by my senior year, so that was freshman year. And then by senior year was the kind of thing where, like, you know, no one outside of the track and cross country teams called me Iceman, but was at the point where the people on the team didn't even know what my real name was because they were so used to just calling me Iceman.
That's hilarious.
Well, like the coaches forgot what my real name was. They just called me Iceman.
That's amazing. See, that's a great nickname, dude.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, it was a real classic. We don't even remember, like, we don't even know the real name. We're so used to the nickname.
See, nobody was that creative with mine. So my last name's Ferretti, so I always got like spaghetti or like ferret.
Again,
like
nothing
stupid things like
about
that.
Con should lead you to, oh yeah, that sounds like Iceman. So it really was just like the worst handwriting I've ever seen that led to it.
That is awesome. That is awesome. So for people that don't know who the great Con / Iceman is, why don't you tell people what it is that you do? What book is it that you work on?
So my name is Ben. So unlike Genghis or Noonan, I am Ben Con. Sing Noonan Con. Yeah, I am Ben Con. I am a Manhattan-based comic book writer. My most recent series is Heavenly Blues with Bruno Hidalgo from Scout Comics. And the sixth and final issue just came out last Wednesday.
It did. Mm-hmm. It did.
The grand finale.
The grand finale. When was the first issue put out? Like almost a year ago, right?
The first issue, July 2016. So the first four issues came out monthly, and that took us until the end. Yeah, the first four issues came out monthly from July to December. Then we had to take a month off to finish five, which came out in February. And then issue six came out in May.
Awesome. So I know your work because you were on another podcast on this network. You were on Best of the Rest with Jay and Dennis a couple of times.
Yeah, I love those guys.
And that's how I was introduced to your book. And I ended up getting Shaman, which you also did with a different publisher.
Yes, Shaman is a graphic novel I did also with Bruno Hidalgo on art. Jason Arthur did the letters. And that was published by Locust Moon Press as a graphic novel. And that's currently also available on Comixology, on Amazon, and on my Etsy store. So, you know, probably hard. I doubt Diamond has too many copies these days, but it's still pretty easy to get your hands on it.
So how'd you hook up with Bruno, by the way? Because I'd never made a connection that he also worked on Shaman.
Yeah, so that was, again, Locust Moon. Really, the guys at Locust Moon, Chris Stevens, Andrew Carl, they were the ones who served as editors on Shaman, and they really taught me everything I know about actually like making comics, like the actual act of like, you know, I kind of figured out how to write a script, but how to take a script into something that's existent in stores, that's entirely thanks to their tutelage. So they had done recently done an anthology with Dark Horse called Once Upon a Time Machine, of which the second volume actually came out just last April, Once Upon a Time Machine Volume 2, which is about Greek mythology. And I have a story in there with Alexandria Huntington, so That's Once Upon a Time Machine Volume 2 from Dark Horse Comics. Go track that down.
Nice.
And so based off this Once Upon a Time Machine anthology they've done, they kind of had this whole roster of artists, you know, that they knew, had worked with, could kind of vouch for. So that was kind of the talent pool we were looking at together. And then Bruno, who had done a sci-fi Humpty Dumpty story for the anthology.
That's awesome.
He kind of really jumped out as someone that, from a technical perspective, could capture everything I wanted to do, but also just had this very unique and raw style that would just add so much personality and character to it. And so they were really the ones that put me and Bruno together. And then him and I just had so much fun working together on Shaman that I pretty much the day after Shaman was finished, we started work on Heavenly Blues.
Wow, really? That soon?
Yeah. So, I mean, I knew by the time we were wrapping up the fifth issue, I knew this is what I wanted my next project to be. And especially at that point, I'm like, especially for what I knew the story was, I couldn't imagine having anyone else but Bruno on it. And I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Can you guys imagine anyone else but Bruno on Heavenly
Blues?
Yeah,
he's freaking awesome. He was awesome. So what's your background? How'd you get involved in writing a comic?
So I started my first kind of webcomic started when I was 15, freshman in high school, and I stole in-game art sprites from the Kingdom Hearts Game Boy Advance spin-off game, Kingdom Hearts Chain of Memories. And there were these sites back in the day where they're like, you know, when sprites were more thing, they would just like rip. Do you ever hear those, like, the term sprite sheet?
Yeah.
Where it's like all the various parts of the character.
Yep.
So I would take so I took all the Kingdom Hearts sprite sheets, ignored every single thing about Kingdom Hearts except for what these characters looked like and their names, and I manipulated them in Microsoft Paint, and I made my own like 4-panel Kingdom Hearts reality show webcomic. And I did this for 7 years. I made over 700 4-panel strips of this.
Holy cow.
Yeah. I did this for a long time because I love webcomics. So as an adolescent, what I saw as kind of the height of comic making was webcomics. And so that's what I wanted to make. I wanted to make webcomics. So I'm like, so that's what I did. I made my little Kingdom Hearts webcomic. And then I got to college. And then I found – and there was a comic book shop right off campus, and it was like a revelation. Like, the scales fell from my eyes. Like, this is what comics could be. I saw, you know, in the entirety of Marvel, DC, all the great Vertigo classics, Image on the verge of, you know, becoming what it was. Like, this was, you know, we're talking like 2008, 2009 at this point. Mm-hmm. So, and I became utterly obsessed. And essentially, I remember the exact moment where I decided I wanted to be a comic writer. I could tell you the whole thing, what I was reading, where I was, what I was thinking. So really, I feel like I'm in kind of the unique position of, by the time I decided I wanted to make comics, I had already been making comics for 4 years.
Interesting. That's quite a jump, though. Quite a jump from webcomics to actual printed books.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 No, that's interesting. I heard the story when you were on that on Best of the Rest with those guys, and I thought it was freaking hilarious. Because I mean, I think we're roughly about the same age. I remember playing the hell out of some Kingdom Hearts, dude. And to hear that story, kind of it tickled my heart. You know what I'm saying? Like I got that nostalgic feeling a little bit.
Oh my god! And I mean, great game. I would say easily the game that changed my life more than any other. But again, for almost nothing to do with the actual game itself, just with the comics that let me make.
So have you thought about like resurrecting that as a feature story, making that into a comic?
Oh, I mean, it was a different era. It's the, you know, it was the mid-2000s. There's, quite frankly, you could just do and say stuff back then you can't do and say now.
Well, I don't know, dude. Like, if you had the right publisher, you might be able to say a lot more than you think.
It was the time of South Park and the Chappelle Show. And
the greatest era of mankind.
Yes. It was a 15-year-old's It was a 15-year-old creating humor for 14-year-olds.
No, I hear you. I hear you.
No, look, I mean, I'm very proud of what I did. I'm way more proud of what I've done since then. But it's the kind of thing where, you know, if I don't do this, if I don't do that, there's no way I ever do this.
Sure.
I mean, again, this was 700 strips over 7 years where all the character poses were stolen and unoriginal. All the backgrounds were stolen and unoriginal. There were no facial expressions to speak of, just very basic rudimentary physical changes and poses. The vast majority of which were just two people standing opposite from each other having a conversation. So that everything about the comic, the only original bit of it, and what the comic really lived or died on, was the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only place where there was actual creativity, was in the dialogue. And doing 7 years of a comic where the dialogue had to do every ounce of heavy lifting, boy, could I not ask for better training in the whole world.
Well, that's good though, right? Because I think that probably helped you a lot as a writer. Because the amount of character development you've done, both in Shaman and I think in particular with Heavenly Blues, you had to require a lot of practice in order to do that, right? Like those books are very character-centric, right? There's an interesting plot, but that's kind of in the background. It's more about the characters.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the heart of everything, and something where, and you know, especially with the comic and stuff like that, to me, I think about the scripts I write, some of depend, it's the right kind of one in my comfort zone. I kind of think of it a little like a stand-up comedy routine, where it's comedy. So very spoken. So I speak all my dialogue out loud to get a rhythm of the tone. And sometimes it's, you know, that egotistical hope that I've got a voice worth saying something and that'll be fun for people to read. And there's also a sense of, boy, as a writer, I can't have I can't have every character sound the same. So trying to find that unique voice while also making sure that each character has their own voice.
Yeah, I was trying to think back. It seems like, so I've read Shaman. I got a trade of Shaman a few months back after I started reading Heavenly Blues.
I would say LL and Aaron are the ones who resemble my natural speaking voice the most. Shaman when I'm at my wittiest, Coin Counter when I'm at my most annoying.
Oh, I love Coin Counter. He's hilarious.
And then Isaiah is always hard to write dialogue for because it's hard writing for someone so much infinitely cooler than I will ever be.
True, but at the same time, I think there's some, how do I want to put it? There's some themes in Shaman that I think somewhat resurface in Heavenly Blues, right? In particular, the theme of death.
Some big ones come to mind. I'm not going to dive into what exactly they mean. I'll overpay a therapist for that, thank you.
Well, I mean, I kind of wanted to get into that because I thought one of the most interesting things for me about Heavenly Blues is how you played with religion.
Clearly, I do not have a healthy relationship with death. That's abundantly clear. What my relationship with death is, I can't quite figure out. But if Shaman and Heavenly Blues don't convince you that it's wildly unhealthy, I don't know what else to do because these are blatant cries for help. Religion. I mean, well, just the fact that I'm Jewish and heaven and hell aren't a thing in Judaism. I'm approaching from a very secular point of view. I mean, I was never raised to believe in heaven and hell as actual things. They're just the torture dimension and the, I don't know, eternal orgasm dimension. And it always seemed like, well, wait, how and why? And hold on. I have so many questions. Because I didn't hear from an official source like Fire and Brimstone. I heard it from my buddy in fourth grade on the bus being like, hey, what do you hear at religious place? In my place, we just spoke a whole bunch of gibberish, and then I felt guilty for some reason. What do you get? In that synagogue, what do you get? And be like, hell, man, boy, have you heard about hell? And I'm like, I have not. Well, what do you know about the devil? I know they're not doing very well in the NHL this season.
Oh, come on, dude. I used to love the Devils.
Well, this is like 1995. Sure. Like, it's fun. Or sure. Whatever. I don't know how they're doing this season. They might be doing great. But so kind of my very first exposure to heaven, hell, like, especially coming from a religious community that doesn't have an afterlife. We're just not like, hey, you got one life to live. Do good for goodness sake. As the afterlife was like introduced to me, especially in a contest where I'm like, hold on, I haven't heard about any of this stuff. I don't know where you guys are getting your information, but it's not matching up with what I've been hearing. The afterlife was always just something like, as I hear like the rules of it and how it works, I'm like, it was always just like, I have so many questions. So Heavenly Blues in a lot of ways is kind of the fulfillment of a lifelong desire to create a version of heaven and hell that actually answer all of those questions I had.
Well, I thought one thing that was interesting that you did was bringing in the Egyptians in there. Because I think, what is it, like in issue 2 or 3, you pretty much say like, oh yeah, like the angels thought this Egyptian thing was kind of cool, so they based their own heaven and hell kind of after the Egyptian.
And that just comes from like, okay, let's just say heaven and hell are real. Christians, you guys didn't start figuring that shit out until like 2,000 years ago.
Right.
That means nobody dying was go. That means even if they were there, nobody dying was actually going there because they didn't know there were things they could go to. So where the fuck were people going before? I know the Egyptians had a whole thing going on. So it was like, again, a question where I'm like, wait a minute. If this thing started with Christianity, what about the religions older than Christianity? Where do they go?
Right.
So again, it was more just trying to like answer the question. So a big thing was I didn't want them to just seem like, you know, I didn't want hell to just be the torture dimension. I wanted to seem like a real living, breathing city that you can imagine people spending decades or centuries in. And I wanted to kind of reflect the different eras of the people that had made their way through it. So my goal was that, you know, I feel like we just kind of spent a lot of time in a bit of a, you know, Rio favela style slum area. Rio de Janeiro and kind of 1920 Chicago and jazz halls were definitely the big inspirations for hell. Whereas heaven was a bit more of a Paris meets Manhattan, type of deal. We wanted hell especially to kind of look like this scarred, awkwardly stitched together jigsaw of various regions and time periods of the people that inhabited it.
Well, one thing I thought was really interesting, too, is the way that you portray hell, it almost made it seem, in a way, better than being in heaven, right? Because ultimately, both places kind of suck.
Oh, absolutely. And it's very much this sense that whether it's a place to do nothing or a shiny place to do nothing, the only real sense of living or the only sense of redemption is just have something you're crazy passionate about and just go at it. Like with everything you've got, and that's the only real living there is.
I got a question too, because so we've got 5 main characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we got Isaiah, Aaron, Hideki, Turner, and Amunet.
Yes.
And one thing that I really liked about their portrayal here is that, and I think you kind of beat through this as you go through the series, is that these aren't necessarily bad people, right? But they're in hell. And one thing that I found really interesting is that it's almost like they're in this place just because they wouldn't conform to norms in whatever society they were in. In particular, like Amunet, right?
Absolutely.
The only reason she's there is because she wouldn't do what the Pharaoh told her to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's someone so like empowered and strong and in a world that that just punished her so much for that. It's easy to see why she spent like thousands of years taking the easy route, and it was really nice getting to see her kind of reawaken that independent spirit, especially now being paired, especially with someone like Coin Counter, who could not give less of a fuck about, you know, the moral orthodoxy or how he's supposed to live a life. So I think it was also their dynamic was really fun because I feel like they brought out not only the best in each other, but kind of the most entertaining aspects of each other.
Right. Well, and Coin Counter is interesting because the only reason he does, like, he came upon this worldview is that he was dying anyway.
Yeah, and to me, one thing that was fun about it is that I'd argue that, like, all five characters ended up in hell for a different reason. Isaiah, you know, was a bank robber who killed some people, and he knows that. He knows what life he lived. He lived it with open eyes, and he knows that when you tally up the acts, no, there's no real question which way, which way he goes. Erin could not be the more converse. Her attitude is that she was given no real options for any kind of life, saw one scant chance and took it, and has been punished ever since for what she feels she had no responsibility over. Mm-hmm. And so she is beyond just furious at her lot in the afterlife. Hideki very much blames himself for one terrible thing that happened at the very end of his life. And whether or not he should be blamed for it, it's clear that he's decided to punish himself and almost made the conscious decision of wanting to be in hell. Amunet, it's again like she died before hell was even a thing, but in her flashback, you kind of see her being like trading away her freedom. So you kind of see what leads her to her lot in the afterlife. And then Coin Counter, again, he's a phone. He just thinks, what the hell kind of outlaw would he be if he ended up in heaven?
Right.
Ain't no outlaw worth his salt. Don't land in perdition.
Yeah, I think out of all of them, the one that I was, that I understood the least about why he was here was Hideki. Because he seemed like a typical, like, really honorable, like, feudal Japan. I guess he was a ninja, not a samurai, but
He was specifically from the Iga clan. So of all, because none of the characters are real people, sure. I didn't want to kind of be handcuffed by history like that. But the circumstances of Hideki's death are the most historically based. Like that was a real battle. Like Oda Nobunaga in 1582 invading the Iga province. Like out of revenge for the Iga clan, like defeating his son 2 years earlier, like all of that absolutely happened in real feudal era Japan. So with Hideki, it was really just, and because I wanted to establish that even the characters themselves don't always know why they're in hell, and they all have theories. But for Hideki, it was like his daughter dying, and his daughter dying in his arms. As he fought to try to help his family escape, and while his wife and son escaped, he did lose his eldest child. And I think in his head, like, that's most horrible. So he died feeling the full weight of the absolute worst moment imaginable for a parent. And I think that, like, just the pure weight of that sadness is what turned him from, again, in life, this beloved father, community leader, teacher, into a pathetic drug addict sleeping in garbage, which is where, like, we find him in issue 3.
Yep.
And so it's really, and I think in his mind, it's like, you know, he chose not to fight until the very last minute. Maybe if he'd just run away earlier, maybe if he'd fought earlier, and since maybe if he'd done literally anything than what he did. And now his entire identity is just wrapped up in the family he couldn't save, and then the family that did live on that he's just watching obsessively now. And it kind of takes just the events, like, you know, this kind of new family of thieves around him, especially some of the bond him and Erin form, which you especially you see in issue 3, to just kind of give him a bit of a new lease on life and actually be, like, aware and active for his own sake again for the first time in centuries.
What was your favorite character to write out of all these?
Oh, man. Erin's dialogue was the most fun to write. No doubt about that. Writing a good Erin tirade. There is nothing as fun as writing a good Erin tirade. and then, I mean, this is a bad answer because I'm going to say pretty much all of them, but again, like, I never, like, with Shaman, I'd gotten to write, like, a lot of, like, wisecracking assholes, which, like, you know, we saw, which Aaron fit that role to the T. Mm-hmm. But I never, but that kind of, like, I never gotten to write someone kind of like that with that suaveness, with a bit of debonair, a bit of, like, that kind of, like, all gears always turning, like, kind of charismatic mastermind that Isaiah ended up becoming. So it was really great getting to write that kind of character, you know, trying to, like, really trying to make that kind of, you know, loop crazy loop in the third, the, you know, those kind of fun master thieves, and seeing him kind of rediscover that in real time was great. So I had a lot of fun. So he was a really unique and satisfying writing experience. And then Coin Counter is probably the most, when he's not in Western drawl, his mannerisms are probably, his, like, style of speech is probably the most similar to myself. And then him and Amunet were the most explicit kind of, like, flirtation and romance that I've written. And again, like, got to do kind of a lot more with them than I did with the mild flirtations that were in some issues of Shaman. So that was another really fun and new writing experience.
I think for me as a reader, I really loved Erin. There was a lot to like about her. For one, I love the history of, like, the Salem witch trials and, like, the real reasoning behind all that stuff.
And oh, yeah. I mean, there's my favorite. Did you know that there's my, can I tell you, Detroit, can I tell you my favorite Salem witch story from the Salem witch trials?
Sure.
So if you look at all the way people executed, it was all, you know, no one was actually burned at the stake. It was all hanging. And one guy who was crushed to death.
Right.
And the reason he was crushed to death, because that was the punishment if you just straight up refuse to enter a plea. If you refuse to say if you're innocent or guilty, it's like, how do you plea? Nothing. It's like, well, we're just going to crush you until you say something. And the reason it was because he was accused of witchcraft by his neighbor, who was very blatantly just trying to steal his land.
Right.
Just wanted his farmland. So what happens is, once you get accused of witchcraft, either you go, like, I'm innocent, and they go, like, no, you're not guilty. Ha ha, state takes your farm, state takes your land. Or you go, I'm guilty, total witch. And they're like, witches can't own land. We get that. And then, you know, the neighbor would then, like, you know, buy it for pennies on the dollar.
Yep.
But by being executed without ever entering a plea, the land went, instead of, like, you know, the instead of losing the land due to, like, witchcraft crimes, the land instead was went directly to his sons, and they were able to keep it.
That's crazy. Yeah, that whole era is freaking insane, dude.
So yeah, like, in terms of research, like, Hideki slash era, tried to be very historically accurate on Aaron's flashback. You know, that Judge Hathorne, you know, ancestor of Nathaniel Hawthorne, who hated his freaking ancestor and wrote Scarlet Letter, mm-hmm. which actually I would say, like, you know, the character of Pearl, Pym, and Scarlet Letter is the biggest inspiration for Aaron. And even though Scarlet Letter didn't take place in Salem Witch Trials, that book was the biggest kind of thing that informed that whole flashback and chapter, especially just, like, the treatment of Aaron as, like, kind of a bastard child, mm-hmm. as we learn. But, you know, in terms of research, the Salem Witch Trials took place over 2.5 months, and it was the summer, but I wanted winter scenes, so that's just what I did.
Hey, it's your story. You can do whatever you want.
Exactly. So it's like, I did enough historical research to know when I didn't even want to be historically accurate.
No, that's fair enough. But, like, you get a lot of plot advancement through her, too. I think one of my favorite scenes in all 6 issues is a very mundane scene, because Aaron goes to, like, a support group in hell, and I thought that was just completely hilarious that they have support groups in hell for people to talk out, like, why it is that they're here.
Again, that was a part of just trying to, like, think of what it would look like if it were not just thinking, you know, lakes of fire where people are getting stabbed forever, but a place where people got, like, shit, I woke up, I got 12 hours to fill. The fuck do I do with it? Well, so, yeah, just trying to imagine them as people with things to fill and, like, what kind of needs they would have. So that was kind of a rewritten version of another script. But, yeah, just trying to also just try to show that as much as Erin kind of represents the very idea of a child who died and was sent to hell and is now like grown up, still a kid, her experience isn't a monolith. There's an entire support group of kids who have been in hell just as long as Erin, and yet there's clearly something like different and more broken or a little even more out there with Erin that are issues that she's dealing with that they're not. So even just showing that as much as Erin may represent one experience, there's still a multitude of that experience that we're not even seeing.
Well, and I guess ultimately that's what leads them to take this thing on, right? Because they're all bored as crap.
Absolutely. That to me, that was the real hell, was born. Like, the real hell was lack of purpose, and this heist gives them all that purpose again. And to me, it's like, even before, it's like, it's the very act of doing this heist and the fact that they have something they're working passionately towards that no one else in the afterlife has. To me, in a certain sense, they're already alive, even while still in the afterlife at a certain point.
So why'd you choose to make an angel the bad guy of the story?
So which angel are you talking about?
I would say more Barbiel than Nuriel.
So I think that was more... So with Barbiel, I think it was trying to, you know, in terms of when you're dealing with bad people, you always have to think about who, you know, who can you put them up against that'll be worse. So your main characters are still likable. So I kind of thought about, you know, people like Andy Garcia or in Ocean's 11 or the mobster in Sting, and how it was kind of like these upper class kind of hoity-toity on top of the world, think no one can touch them kind of characters. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wanted – so I felt like a demon character would almost – their motive – if it was a demon trying to get to hell or something like that, because there also just needed to be the narrative standpoint of how the hell do they get out of hell into heaven.
Right.
And an angel opens the way is a very easy way to do it. Like a demon, I felt their motivations would have been too similar. So I felt with the angel, I could have like there was something supportive but very immediately not trustworthy there. And that was very much the kind of relationship I wanted them to have with their quote unquote employer, someone that, you know, whose side they were on right up until they weren't. And I kind of wanted to, especially once it was about human struggle and feeling alive and humanity, I kind of wanted to bring that, you know, say that Andy Garcia has a sense of smugness, of being feeling better, of above it all. And I just kind of wanted to take those just punch him in the face qualities and put that on Barbiel. So even when, to me, kind of the main villain, Uriel, doesn't get introduced in issue 4, already there's this kind of presence you already are suspicious of to add a little more tension early on.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Ooh, I know that was long-winded, but I hope it was help.
It makes sense. It makes sense. I almost wish when I was reading it, I hadn't read the little issue synopsis on some of this stuff because as I was reading along, I would go and see what the next issue was going to be about, and I would see things and names pop up on there, and I'm like, okay, and that gets my mind thinking on things, right? Because I've got certain bits of knowledge that about, you know, like Barbiel and Uriel, and what kind of role I would expect them to have in the story.
Uriel, there was a character who changed very dramatically, almost at like the very last possible second. Mm. And I think for the better. Originally, Uriel was kind of like, he was still kind of like this, you know, bearded war, like old soldier, but it was just kind of like, you know, he'd been cool back in the day, but it had gone to his head and he was totally out of it now, like gut, kind of thought he was still tough shit, but was, you know, really just kind of just another really just kind of like a blowhearted fool for our heroes to like satisfyingly like get one over on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a person that wouldn't hold a party as part of an elaborate trap, but would just do it out of like vanity and a need for kind of self-congratulations. And that was pretty much the vision I had of the character right up until, like, say, 2 pages into the script before his first appearance.
Huh.
And honestly, what kind of triggered the change was I thought, well, what if he had a Scottish accent?
Okay.
And with that little change, he became, like, this kind of fucking, like, outer shape has been in Florida into this, like, high, like, Scottish Highlander motherfucker of a demon, of a man. Like, broad, like, hulking figure, broad shoulders. Like, he went from being, like, vain and self-conscious to being the most supremely comfortable person. Like, I love that the first 2 issues, you see him in sweatpants because he's the freaking Archangel Uriel. Like, he's not here to impress you or anyone else. Like, kind of the fight scenes he ended up getting to be in issue 6 never would have been possible with my original conception. And he ended up, and instead of just being this fool for them to, like, you guys to laugh as he gets one over on, to me, it was a lot more fun to write him as, like, as a terrifying figure, as the last person you would ever want to steal from. And he became so, and I found that this villainous character that, in my head, I was kind of not really looking forward to writing. I wasn't sure how it would go. I found absolutely commanded the page anytime he was on panel. And he kind of became this wonderful, like, immovable object to the team's unstoppable force. And just and because of just this very last-minute change, I think just totally changed him into a much more satisfying adversary.
Well, he's the final boss. He can't be a pushover.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I dig that. So I got to ask you. I don't want to spoil the rest of the story. But I do know that this book was optioned last year. I want you to tell me a little bit what that means.
So what it currently means is that a production company, in this case 51 Minds, has obtained the exclusive rights to try to produce the movie. In this first step, in the first stage, that means attaching a writer, director, and a possible star. So attaching your basic creative talent to the project. And then if that goes well, your next step is to potentially try to sell it to a studio or acquire funding in some other manner. So in this case, it was optioned, and we're still at the point, and we're currently still at the point where we're looking to attach a potential writer or director to the project.
So I got to ask you, when you were the Iceman on the track team, did you ever think that you would have the possibility of something that you created become possibly a major motion picture?
I had a webcomic with a few thousand daily visitors, and I thought that was the utter peak of creative success.
You're not going to turn into Hollywood Iceman, are you?
Well, I mean, there's only one Aaron Ashmore, except there isn't because he's a freaking twin. There's multiple Ashmores. You're two of a kind, both Ashmore siblings.
I hear you. But no, it's good though, right? Because, you know, I think in some respects that can help you get other projects that you might want to work on maybe put out somewhere, right, where you might reach a bigger audience. Because one thing that I found, and we're not going to go in depth into this, that, you know, unless I can get Heavenly Blues at a shop, it's tough finding it, right? Like, you can get it from the Scout website.
Yeah. I mean, again, physical copies are real easy to just purchase from the Scout website.
Yeah. So I want you to tell me a little bit about working with Scout. Like, how did you approach Scout? Did you pitch them? Or were they familiar with Shaman?
First met some of the Scout staffers at some conventions where I was tabling and they were tabling. They saw Shaman Thought School, and then I was also at that point starting to debut Heavenly Blues. And they seemed to really like the look of it, think it was cool. They encouraged me to pitch the Scout, so they kind of talked it up, encouraged me to do it. And then at New York Comic Con in 2016, I met, Brendan Neen, James Pruitt, mm-hmm. Your head honchos over there. And I gave them, and so I kind of formally pitched it there in New York Comic Con. And then, they moved, they were interested quickly. I pitched it to them Saturday. By Monday, we were writing up a contract. They worked with it quickly, and then they've been great to work with. I mean, it's been, Shaman was great to have out there, but it was also an original graphic novel. So to me, after that, kind of the next step was, boy, wouldn't it be great if I could have, like, a monthly miniseries come out in individual issues. So really, it's been great working with Scout and getting, they've been great to work with. And the, again, it's been so surreal and honestly amazing, and I hope I never get used to just the image of a book that I made with my characters in, like, freaking, Forbidden Planet and Midtown and tiny shops all over. Like, that's awesome!
Yeah, that is awesome.
Fucking A!
That is awesome. Yeah, I talked to James a little bit at a con I went to a few months back. I talked to Joe a lot, his brother, who is over at Aftershock. Mm-hmm. Because we do an Aftershock podcast on the network, and he's been amazing to chat with off the record and a lot of things.
Put a good word in for me there if you got a chance.
I sure will. I'll make sure to do so. But it was cool because I went to the table and I was looking to see what they had, and I started flipping through the boxes, and they had all your issues in there. And I was like, oh, this Ben guy. I talked to him on Twitter. I've heard him on podcasts before. He's awesome. So yeah, it was cool to see.
That's awesome. I mean, it is really cool. And again, they're at cons. They've got the books there and that kind of support on that side. Like, the work they do, getting it to reviewers, getting it in stores, being at cons. So it's my first time kind of having the backing of a real publisher, and it's been a great experience.
Yeah, I'm sure it helps a lot. I'm sure it takes some weight off your shoulders, too. All right, yeah. Ben, I know that you're a huge Batman, Superman, Justice League fan.
Yes.
And every time I have a creator on...
I love the ever-changing, unfolding tapestry that is the DC Universe. I truly believe that the Marvel and DC Universe is, like, the product, especially the in canon, like, real, the product of dozens, if not hundreds, of writers, artists, designers, animators, filmmakers and actors, all in like a shared, in this level of shared universe over the same narrative for over 80 years, I truly believe these superhero universes are the most ambitious narrative experiments of all time.
I like it. So every week when I have a creator on, I always wrap up with a quiz. And because you're a Batman, Superman, and Justice League fan.
Yes. Oh, I'm either going to fuck this up or because I was born for this moment.
You will be partaking in the ultimate Justice League trivia challenge.
Yes. Oh, I do love Justice League.
All right. I got to ask you, how many times have you seen it?
Justice League, despite my Twitter, I know I recently tweeted, I'm going to go see it for a seventh time. But real talk, 4 times.
All right. Fair enough. So I saw it 5 times in theaters. And I have to see it at home still, but I will. I just got to carve out some time.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking. Yeah, I saw it twice in theaters and twice at home.
See, there's no shame in our game, dude. Everyone crafts in Justice League. You know what? Screw you. It was a great movie.
Man, I felt like I was watching a big 2-hour like live action Justice League Unlimited.
Hell
and
yeah.
What the hell else could anyone ever want from a Justice League movie?
Are you ready?
I feel like you could've... Yes.
Are you ready to partake in this challenge?
Yes. Let's do it.
All right. How many mother boxes appear in the film?
So I'm just trying to think if this is... I know Steppenwolf is after 3, but I'm trying to just make sure there isn't like a 4th one that appeared in the flashback, and this is something like a tricky one. All right, I'm going to go with 3.
3 is correct.
Yes.
All right, question 2. The Green Lanterns were present when Steppenwolf first attempts to conquer and remake Earth. True or false?
True.
Very true. Dude, they've been putting a Green Lantern in like all these movies, and nobody says anything about it.
That's because more than any other brand, Green Lantern is so badly damaged.
did you see Deadpool?
I haven't seen Deadpool 2 yet.
All right, there's a Green Lantern joke in there. Just look out for it.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, I've seen Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad. Yeah, I think I've seen 4 times as well. And I know it has problems, but good God, is it just an endless source of joy. Like,
hell yeah.
I know so much of it shouldn't work, and I get why it doesn't work for a lot of people, but, like, every part of it just does work for me.
Hey, it was fun. I took my 7-year-old to see it. We saw it in theaters twice. It was fun. Whatever.
Oh, it was super, super fun. I have a big smile on my face the whole time I see it. So, like, I hate that the conversation is so poisoned that I need to, like, give a disclaimer to. I like a movie. Fuck you, toxically negative internet. But it is fun. I'm like, as well, I feel like I love, like, when it comes to, like, Man of Steel, like, I don't even get the criticism. Like, I just love it. Green Lantern is the one where I'm like, oh, no, this one I fucking get. You may have been a little too kind on this one.
Agreed.
Also, to keep looking, like, the director of Thor Ragnarok is Ryan Reynolds' buddy.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, he's just his best friend character who does not appear after, like, halfway through the movie. Dude, go watch that movie. There's a scene where Halle goes to visit his brother and nephew, and they're like, we're disappointed in you. And he's like, I know, but I'll have a character arc. Yeah, they never appear again. The brother, the rest of his family never shows up again. They're gone. They have one scene to be like, we're disappointed in you, and then they just vanish forever.
All right, I guess I'll have to see it one more time.
The only good thing to come out of that movie was that Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively look adorable together.
Yeah.
They look like they'd be fun to have brunch with.
Hell yeah.
All right, next question.
Who is the first future Justice League member that Bruce visits?
That'd have to be Aquaman.
Aquaman is correct. In the comics, Aquaman's trident has 3 prongs. How many does it have in Justice League?
5.
Would that make it a pentadent, I guess? Yeah.
Makes it Aquaman's fuck stick is what it makes.
Which of these companies from Batman comic book lore appear in the film? Wayne Enterprises? Janus? Oh, damn it. I lost the other one. Well, we'll do between those two. Wayne Enterprises or Janus?
I mean, I guess Wayne Enterprises.
That is incorrect.
Oh, no.
It's Janus.
That's
okay.
That's dumb. I don't know what Janus is.
It's stupid. It doesn't matter. Which of these DCU characters appeal... Oh, yeah. Which character from the DC Extended Universe appears in the film in a blink-and-you'll-miss-it moment? This is a villain that appears in another movie.
A villain that was in Justice League. Well, I guess that was in another DCU movie. That would have to be Lex Luthor.
So close. It's Ares.
Oh, he is in the Flash.
Yes.
I mean, what I liked about Justice League was I felt like almost every leaguer had a really fun or developed or interesting dynamic with every other leaguer. Like, yeah. I like that I can watch them and be like, I know how Superman and Cyborg interact, and Superman and Flash, and Batman. Like, I know how Aquaman and Batman are, and Aquaman and Cyborg, and Cyborg and Flash, and Wonder Woman and Flash, and Wonder Woman and Cyborg, and Wonder Woman and... Like, I just like that I feel like I have a very clear map of how... Like, I just like how, even though the movie felt very well-paced and very, like, focused, it felt like there was enough time to really just develop everyone... And having all those individual dynamics well established, to me, really just sold the whole thing as like the emotional heart of this of the movie being just this team coming together.
Agreed. All right. Which villainous faction does Lex Luthor tease in the post-credit scene?
So my first thing is to say Legion of Doom, but he specifically says League of Our Own, so I'd have to go with the Injustice League.
That is correct. Who is the colleague we see Jim Gordon talking to at the GCPD? This was a hard one, dude. I couldn't remember this.
I mean, I feel like it can't be Bullock, because I would almost remember if it was Bullock.
Yeah, that would be too easy if it was Bullock.
And again, I would have remembered Montoya.
Not Montoya.
Fuck. I'm going to go with Smitty.
Oh, the right answer is Crispus Allen, a.k.a. the Spectre.
Shit, that was a good Easter egg.
Mm-hmm. Could you imagine if they did a Spectre movie? That'd be freaking awesome.
I mean, Justice League Dark.
Yeah.
Hell, I'm still hoping that'll come.
It's coming soon, kind of.
I need them to do it because there's no other fucking way I'm going to get. I have a Lego superhero collection where I just collected like all the minifigures. And normally I'm good with customs, but no way anyone can do a good custom Swamp Thing. And so a Justice League Dark movie is the only way I'm getting a good Lego Swamp Thing.
Yeah, and hopefully good, because the animated Justice League Dark was okay.
Yeah, some characters were served better than others.
Yeah, it was all right.
You know, Constantine and Etrigan got a lot of development. Swamp Thing was used very weirdly. Zatanna and Deadman, BB+.
Yeah. Whose idea is it to use one of the mother boxes to resurrect Superman?
Batman. And it is hilarious, because Batman goes from zero to necromancy in like 2 seconds.
Oh.
It's great. Cyborg goes like, it's an energy source, and Batman's first immediate thought is, let's use it to bring Superman back from the dead. Like, why do you even think that's a thing you can do? You jumped immediately to that.
Because he's Batman.
Batman was clearly just hoping that would be a thing. Like, you've been thinking about this, Batman. The one thing I like is that if you go back to Batman v Superman, you can kind of see General Zod's body, like, a year and a half later. Mm-hmm. So I thought about that. I'm like, oh, shit, they actually set up a film before that Kryptonian bodies don't decay.
Mm. Yeah, like, yeah.
That's why I have decay. Nothing like, and then I'm like, you know what they actually set that up in a previous movie. Zod's body was fine a year and a half later. Yep. Checks out.
Yep. Which Stephen King novel does Flash reference prior to Superman's return?
Pet Sematary.
That's right. Where does Superman and Flash agree to race to in the mid-credit scene?
Pacific Ocean
is correct. How many times does Steppenwolf make reference to Darkseid, or Darkseid if you're a hipster?
Well, Darkseid is.
He is.
I want to say twice.
Twice is incorrect. The right answer is one time. Do you think they'll ever put Darkseid in one of these movies?
I feel like we're going to get some like solo movies for a while, which I don't mind. Because my answer towards it is less than ideal CGI. I thought Steppenwolf was serviceable. You know, it was all about the six heroes, so a fairly generic villain, but definitely not the worst villain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would still rank Steppenwolf above, say, Enchantress or Malekith, the Dark Elf.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, if that had been... At the same time, I'm also going to be okay because it's Steppenwolf, and, you know, who really cares too much about Steppenwolf?
Right.
If that had been Darkseid, boy, would that have been a disappointment.
Yeah, there's no way they could have been Darkseid. Not in the first movie like this.
No, so, like, I do think it helped. I mean, honestly, especially after how Infinity War did, I'm like, does the public even have enough goodwill for DC to do Darkseid? I feel like you need a certain amount of audience faith.
Eventually. I think what they need to do is do a couple of these solo ones and then do another Justice League, maybe bring in the New God somehow, and then they can do Darkseid.
Yeah, I mean, Ava DuVernay's doing that. I hope I'm not mispronouncing that. I probably am. I'm so shit at pronouncing
names. I think that's right.
Okay, Ava DuVernay's doing New Gods. That would be amazing. I'm personally hoping for Gwendolyn Christie and Oscar Isaac as Barda and, nice. And Miracle.
Yeah.
And then if I can throw out a third, who I think is kind of like the Ron to this, or like, you know, the third, but I think the third in Trinity, I think Michael B. Jordan could be a real good Orion.
That'd be awesome.
That's who I'd go with. So that could be cool. But right now, I feel like there's so many rumors when it comes to DC movies. Like, you know, like, hey, someone saw they're fucking doing Blue Beetle on a cocktail napkin. Everyone's going to run wild with that for a week. My attitude is, I'm like, I can't, like, Aquaman, Shazam, and Wonder Woman 2. Like, that's what I'm going to do. Anything else, when it officially starts production, I'll start getting invested.
Yep.
But my heart can only take so much drama.
Yeah, one thing at a time. There's been, dude, most of the drama has been with the Batman stuff, too. Because Affleck's like, well, yeah. I'm done. And I'm not done, but I'll direct it. No, I'm going to act in it. And like, eh, whatever. Just do the damn movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Which Batman villain does Alfred reference in the movie?
Penguin.
Penguin. You might be the only other person that knew that, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. That, yeah.
Then that line was in the trailer.
I know.
Speaking of specifically the wind-up Penguin from Batman Returns, which reminds me, this whole episode would just be, this would be a super meta episode of It's Always Sunny, but I'd love to do an episode where Robin Lord Taylor, the Gotham Penguin, like, guest stars on It's Always Sunny and essentially just tries to, like, single white female steal, like, Danny DeVito's, like, Frank's life. It would be super meta, but I really feel it could work.
Dude, he's freaking awesome in that show.
Oh, he's, I mean, I haven't watched too much of it, but he's definitely been my favorite part.
Man, I just watched the season finale. Holy moly, was that good.
Man, I watch all the CW superhero shows, and that honestly feels like a part-time job.
All right, I have two more questions. Which correctional facility do we learn Lex Luthor has escaped from?
Arkham.
Arkham is correct. And the final question, another Easter egg. An actor from which previous DC film made a cameo appearance as a police officer?
As a police officer? Oh,
this is a hard one. I'll give you a hint.
Shit, it's the guy, like, it's like this cop that was there when Superman first came back, right?
Yes, correct.
Oh, man. And he was in a live-action show.
A live-action movie.
A live-action movie. He had to have been in one of the super, in one of, like, oh, wait. No, couldn't have been the...
You're very close. You almost said it.
Could have been, like, the commissioner from, like, the original... Like a Burton Batman movie?
You're close. It's actually the actor that played Jimmy Olsen in the original Superman film.
Oh.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to tally up these.
That's a tough one.
It is a tough
one. That's a tough one.
Ben, right. You got...
I look like a B. I'm a solid B. I was always a B student.
You got 1,237 points. That all makes right. You the winner of the Justice League Trivia Challenge.
Woo!
So every week when I have a creator on, I always give stuff away because I believe in supporting indie people. And since I can't give away copies of Heavenly Blues because it's not in Comixology, what I'll do is I'm going to give away 2 volume ones of Shaman. So all you need to do is find me on Twitter at Geekvine. You can leave me a comment on the episode, or you can send me a direct message, or you can email comictalktoday@gmail.com, and I will be glad to gift that to you. Ben?
Hello.
Anything else you want to tease that you might be working on?
So, really just want to say all 6 issues of Heavenly Blues are out in stores now. You can purchase copies of them at the Scout Comics web store at scoutcomics.com. There will be a trade of Heavenly Blues covering the full series. That'll be coming out this winter, so keep an eye out in previews for that to come out. And you can follow me at BenTheCon on Twitter.
The Iceman cometh. Cool! I think that's going to wrap it up. I'll be back with another episode tomorrow, because apparently I have nothing better to do.